I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Biden met with allies in Europe yesterday and announced the United States would accept 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. 10 million Ukrainians, that's a quarter of the population, have been forced from their homes because of Russia's brutal attack on the country. NATO announced increased sanctions on Russia and promised to send more military equipment for Ukraine to defend itself. Ukrainian President Zelensky, who spoke to the alliance, reiterated his need for the allies to impose a no-fly zone to protect his people from bombs and missiles, something NATO has refused to do. We asked Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick to join us. He's a Republican representing Pennsylvania's 1st Congressional District, and that's Bucks County and a sliver of Montgomery County. He worked in Ukraine when he was with the FBI. He visited the country and Poland recently with a congressional delegation, and he's co-chair of the bipartisan Congressional Ukraine Caucus. Congressman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning, Marty.
Good morning to you as well. Should the United States, should NATO give Zelensky what he wants, a no-fly zone and MiG-29s?
Well, what we need to give President Zelensky is all the military equipment that he's asked for that he's not yet received. Obviously, the Javelins and Stingers are making their way into the country. It's much harder to get these things in country when the country is now a war zone. So there's going to be plenty of time to look back as to when this item should have been delivered. Nonetheless, when I was over there on both the Ukraine and Poland border, we were able to witness these things coming through. However, there are still things that he has not yet received. The S-300 surface-to-air anti-aircraft missile, he desperately needs. What we need to give Zelensky the opportunity to do is to create and enforce his own no-fly zone. We have not been willing to, or able to give him that yet.
Well, let me follow up on that. He does want a no-fly zone. Is there one that you think can be created that doesn't draw NATO into a war with Russia?
There is. So there's two types of no-fly zones. There's a NATO military no-fly zone, and then there's a UN humanitarian no-fly zone. That can be enforced in-country or it can be enforced externally. So if we give Vladimir Zelensky MiG-29s, which Poland has exportable inventory of, and they have not yet given them, TB2 drones, which Turkey has exportable inventory of, they have not made their way into country yet, and the S-300 surface-to-air missiles, which is essentially the Soviet equivalent of the U.S. Patriot system, the Israeli Iron Dome system. It's not U.S. technology, so we don't have to worry about it falling in the wrong hands, and it's technology that the Ukrainians already know how to use. Croatia, Bulgaria, Slovakia, and Romania all have exportable inventory of these items. So if we get him those three things, he can create and enforce his own no-fly zone. That's what we ought to be doing here.
And do you think with more military weapons and also what you just described, that he can defeat Russian military in Ukraine?
I do. I think if we give him air cover, the support he needs through these weapons that he's asked for, which also include what is referred to as switchblade drones, Marty. So there's the 300 and the version of 600. The 600 switchblade drone actually can carry a Javelin missile, which we're already supplying them, which is the anti-tank weaponry system. If we give them those items, yes, I do believe Ukraine can bog Russia down, as they have managed to do thus far, and create another Afghanistan situation for Russia.
Well, and making sure our listeners and myself, frankly, understand. So you're talking about a no-fly zone with pilots that are Ukrainian, or are they pilots from NATO?
Well, they're Ukrainian fighters. And also, no-fly zones using the drones that they already have and that they're being given. So the TB2 drones are coming from Turkey. The Switchblade drones are coming from NATO and the United States. But this doesn't involve putting NATO troops on the ground. Now, I think everybody, and I've said this everywhere I go, Marty, we all need to be psychologically unpacking in our own brain what Rubicon needs to be crossed before that does happen. Because all we see in the future of Vladimir Putin and what he is, his trajectory that he's on, is one of escalation, not de-escalation. But for the time being, I think what we need to be doing, which we are not yet doing, is getting him all those items that I just mentioned and allow the Ukrainians to fight for Ukraine.
Well, let me ask you about a Rubicon that's getting a lot of attention. If Russia were to use something like chemical weapons or biological weapons or tactical nuclear weapons. Is that a line that is too far?
And this is what was puzzling to me yesterday. Marty, you had this unprecedented meeting of NATO, and I was fully expecting them to come out with some pronouncement to that effect, because there's two types of analyses here. Number one is what is our legal obligations, and second are what are our moral obligations. Our legal obligations come vis-a-vis our membership of NATO in Article 5. Moral obligations are something that we all need to come to terms with on our own. Now, with the Article 5 question, that even in and of itself is undefined. Does a cyber attack implicate Article 5? Nobody's answered that question. Does a chemical or biological attack that may occur in Lviv province and cross over into Poland, does that invoke Article 5? This is what I hope they're having discussions on. I hope they had them yesterday. I hope they're having them today, because at some point we may be in that exact position.
And if we are, I mean, what would your advice be then? What should we do?
I think the first thing we need to be doing is giving Ukrainians what they need to fight. They don't have that yet. And see how that goes. Now, if they are, and I predict that if they are given the surface-to-air protection and the MiG-29s and the TB2 drones and the Switchblades, where they can cover and at least neutralize the Russian forces in the sky, because that's where they're getting bombarded. Ukraine is not losing on the ground right now. In fact, they're doing quite well on the ground. But they have no air protection. They don't have the equipment or the technology to defend against Russian shelling and Russian air attacks. So let's give them that. And, you know, should Putin decide to escalate, well, that's when the NATO countries got to come together and say, where are we going to intervene here? We all remember what happened in Syria. There was a chemical attack, a red line was crossed, and a red line was not enforced. We cannot allow that to happen here.
There have been unprecedented sanctions on Russia, and President Biden yesterday said it's not a deterrence, but it is punishment. That's how he sees sanctions. Should there be more and stricter sanctions on Russia and its leadership?
Absolutely. I wish this stuff wasn't coming piecemeal. So it took the UK and the EU to take the lead on personally sanctioning Vladimir Putin. The United States then followed. It took Canada to take the lead on banning all Russian oil imports before the United States followed. Estonia last week voted for a no-fly zone. They were the first to do that. Do I think we need to be going further on sanctions? Yes. Myself and Bill Keating weeks ago, he's my Democrat colleague here. He and I are the ranking member and chairman of the Europe Subcommittee on Foreign Affairs, to sanction all members of the Russian Duma, their parliament. That just happened yesterday. So there's a lag effect that we're hoping to rectify. Now, what do we need to do further on the sanctions front? We need to sanction not 80% of Russian banks. We need to sanction 100% of Russian banks, because Vladimir Putin controls 100%. We shouldn't sanction 50% of Russia's economy. We should sanction 100% of their economy. There's currently a huge carve-out for 50% of Vladimir Putin's GDP, which is the energy sector. We shouldn't just ban oil imports. We should sanction and punish and impose sanctions on exports of the energy sector. So if we truly want to tighten the noose around Russia's economy to turn the Russian people against Vladimir Putin from the inside, which I thought was the goal from day one, we can't be taking economic half measures. We got to go all the way. And will that result in some economic blowback to particularly Europe? Of course it will. But we need to learn from the lessons of history that if you don't take care of this problem now, it becomes a much more costly problem to deal down the road.
Should NATO accept Ukraine into its alliance?
I will tell you, Marty, I lived over in Ukraine, and that was my responsibility over there. It was my last FBI assignment before I left the FBI and ran for Congress. Those are my friends over there. This is a very personal thing for me. It's why I became the co-chair of the Ukraine caucus on day one of Congress. And I do believe Ukraine should be part of NATO. And my goodness, if people were questioning whether or not they meet the military metrics for NATO membership, I think they're showing the entire world right now what they are made of. And it's something that I saw in them when I lived there, Marty. It's something the whole world should have seen during the Euromaidan revolution, when they took to the streets and essentially exiled Viktor Yanukovych, who had ran on a promise to join the EU, and then retreated and became closer with Vladimir Putin. These are incredibly spirited, incredibly passionate people. They love Ukraine. They want their own independence, their own identity. And I will tell you, Marty, I see a lot in the Ukrainian people that, you know, we read about in the history books about our own independence movement here in the United States and George Washington's Continental Army, where they were taking on a massive military force in England. Obviously, the British were fighting here on our soil. And we're 245 years old, our country. Ukraine's independence is 30 years old. A huge chunk of that country was born after 1991. After they won their independence, they know little of and want no part of Kremlin rule. And I think that's been the severe miscalculation that Putin has made here. He may be able to accomplish his short-term military objectives. He will never, ever be able to hold Ukraine.
Let me ask you about what are Putin's enablers here in the United States. Liz Cheney criticized what she called the Putin wing of the GOP. And we all know that former President Trump, this was a couple of weeks ago, described Putin as savvy and smart when he declared parts of Ukraine independent. How does that help Russia? How does that hurt the United States?
First of all, Vladimir Putin's a war criminal. I'm glad this administration has labeled him as such, and he should be pursued as such. He is a god-awful human being, and anybody, and I've said this across the board, Marty, because on a whole host of issues, you got these fringe elements in Congress and in the country. Sometimes it's talking heads on in the media. If your words and actions are being replayed and retweeted by RT, Russian propaganda television, you ought to do some serious soul searching. I've been very, very disappointed in the conduct and actions and words of many people who are constantly trying to find some conspiracy angle, want to dig deep into Volodymyr Zelensky's past to try to undermine him. Nobody's perfect. This man is showing incredible Winston Churchill-type leadership right now in a manner that has inspired not just everybody in America, but everybody across the world. And when he spoke to our joint session, obviously it was in an auditorium because he was speaking remotely.
Sure.
Standing ovation across the board. The conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, House, Senate, he's done the same in countries across the world. He's getting a standing ovation. He is incredibly inspiring because this is a man who is willing to give up his life for his country. Exhibit A of leadership. And anybody hinting or saying anything to the contrary just doesn't know what they're talking about.
And we're almost out of time here, though. He wants more than a standing ovation, correct?
Yes. And that's been my point to my colleagues. Yes, he's incredibly courageous, but I think Mr. Zelensky is being tired of being told how courageous he is. He wants action. He wants military support. He wants humanitarian support. And my goodness, we have to get them this defensive equipment that they are asking for, Marty. We should not be distinguishing between lethal equipment, i.e. Stingers and Javelins that we're driving across the border, and lethal equipment, i.e. MiG-29s, TB2 drones, S-300s, that have to be flown across the border. Because Vladimir Putin is not distinguishing between the two.
Well, we got to leave it there. Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
You bet. Thanks.
You're welcome. He's a Republican representing Pennsylvania's 1st Congressional District. Much more after the short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. President Biden met with NATO allies, EU leaders, and G7 representatives on Thursday to discuss Russia's war on Ukraine. The nations agreed to impose more sanctions on Russia and send more military aid to Ukraine, as well as increase NATO's presence in some Eastern European countries and more help for the humanitarian crisis. One quarter of Ukraine's population, including half the country's children, have been forced from their homes. Biden announced yesterday the U.S. would accept 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. Now, Ukrainian President Zelensky spoke to the alliance via video link, making yet another plea for more military support, including fighter jets, saying that Russia Russia does not intend to end its aggression in Ukraine. Well, this hour we talk about the meeting in Brussels and the difficult choices that lie ahead, including how NATO would respond if Putin used chemical or nuclear weapons. And we have two guests who have joined us. Michael Kimmage is professor of history at Catholic University, a fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He served on the secretary's policy planning staff at the State Department from 2014 to 2016, where he held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. Michael Kimmage, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Andrea Kendall-Taylor, Senior Fellow, Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And from 2015 to 2018, she was Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And Andrea Kendall-Taylor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be here.
And to our listeners, I want to make sure that you can be part of our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me begin with NATO. And Michael Kimmage, I'll start with you. Is NATO then stronger and even more significant today than it was a month ago, right before the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Certainly it is. You see very strong unity on the core messages of NATO. You see great upticks in commitment from the U.S. and many member states to NATO. You see a revolution in German foreign policy where there's going to be a lot more spending, you know, not always for NATO purposes, but in tandem with NATO. So there's an obvious arc upward in NATO strength and unity over the last month. NATO's role, on the other hand, just to sound one cautionary note,
sure.
NATO's role in Ukraine is still quite ambiguous. It's very concerned. It wants to protect its eastern flank, but I think it's still figuring out what it wants to do on the territory of Ukraine in relation to this new war.
Well, it clearly, and to you, Andrea Kendall-Taylor, just picking up on what Michael Kimmage said there, and when one can sense and see the hesitation on the part of Ukraine, we hear Zelensky, you know, calling for much more than NATO is willing to give. If they can't protect a democracy from, you know, an unprovoked attack, what's the point of NATO?
Well, I mean, this is where there are hard choices having to be made. And I think, you know, the key for NATO now, in my view, is to ensure that the conflict in Ukraine does not spread beyond Ukraine's border. And that seems to be what NATO is working at this time. We saw the announcement that there's going to be four new battle groups being deployed to Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Slovakia. We've heard President Biden, Vice President Harris speak very clearly that NATO will defend every inch of the alliance. And so I think currently that's where the focus is. Certainly the allies are doing everything possible to continue to surge military aid into Ukraine to help it to defend itself. But because Ukraine is not a treaty ally, and that is a decision that the alliance has made, the emphasis is and remains on ensuring that the conflict doesn't spread and protecting the NATO members.
Well, let me quote from Volodymyr Zelensky from yesterday, and I'll put this to you, Michael Kimmage. This is what he said to NATO, and this is a translation from the New York Times. He says, NATO has yet to show what the alliance can do to save people, to show that it is the most powerful defense union in the world. And we are watching the destruction of a country. We're watching half the country's children being forced from their homes. Is there something more that NATO can do?
Well, I certainly sympathize with President Zelensky and very much understand what he's trying to do politically. He's trying to muster the greatest possible support for his country. That makes perfect sense. But NATO, as Andrea just said a moment ago, is a defensive military alliance, and right. Its core responsibility is to its member states. So it's not in the NATO charter, or it's not the strategic mission of NATO to defend democracies the world over. It has a more curtailed and constrained mission. So, you know, I understand why he's asking, I understand why he's criticizing, but he's to a degree mischaracterizing the true nature of NATO.
But if Russia wins, and we can talk about, you know, what that actually means, but if somehow Russia is able to force Zelensky to the negotiation table to either give up all of his country or part of his country, Michael Kimmich, does that hurt NATO?
It complicates a lot of what NATO does. We can add one other detail to the story, which is that Russia has semi-annexed Belarus over the last couple of weeks, and that already pushes Russian military assets and soldiers much closer to NATO borders than was the case even a couple of months ago. And if Russia were to partition the country or to assert itself in some permanent way within the territory of Ukraine, it's a nightmare for NATO. It makes for a great deal of instability on NATO's border, and it's just drawing NATO and Russia that much closer to each other and upping the possibility of some kind of direct conflict. So it's a terrible development for NATO, for sure.
Indeed. And let me toss a question to you, Andrew. This is from John, who says, why hasn't Ukraine been able to get into NATO for all these years? What's the answer to that?
Well, I think it's a great question, and certainly we've seen kind of several rounds of NATO enlargement, over the years. And there has been a decision by members of the alliance where they have had more hesitation, I think, in terms of bringing in countries that sit closest to Russia, including Ukraine, but also, Georgia and other countries in that region. And the reason I think is because of the risks that are involved with bringing those countries in. And that is primarily once you put NATO into those countries, then we are obligated by treaty to defend those countries should Russia attack. There's also kind of a precarious time period from when a country applies for NATO membership until when they are actually admitted into the alliance. And that would be, a really critical and very dangerous moment for the alliance, I think, in terms of the risks of putting NATO in direct military confrontation with Russia, which is, a very significant nuclear power. And so those have been the kind of careful calculations that NATO has had to make over the years in terms of that calibrated risk and what they would be willing to accept. Because what we don't want to do is expand the boundaries of NATO and then not be there to defend them. Mm. And because that would undermine the entire alliance. And so there has been that careful calculation over time. Certainly, one of the reasons that we are in this position today is that in 2008 at the Bucharest summit, NATO did express this policy of an open door. It has held out the prospects that over time and with certain reforms that countries would have the ability to enter the alliance. We just haven't progressed, and there doesn't seem to be, very clearly there is not an appetite among all the members of NATO to allow Ukraine into NATO at this time.
I mean, I understand how complicated it is, but to you, Andrea, is NATO then willing to essentially give up Ukraine, allow Russia to take Ukraine in order to, in a sense, protect itself?
It's a good question. I don't think that NATO is, giving up on Ukraine in that sense. I mean, like we, Michael and I have been saying, Ukraine is not a member of NATO.
Right.
But certainly we the alliance is about defending and deterring Russian aggression. And so NATO member states have mobilized in a very significant way to try to enhance Ukraine's ability to defend itself from Russian aggression. There has, the Biden administration has given more military aid to Ukraine this year than any other previous administration. We see Sweden, Sweden, not even a NATO member state, stepping up, providing aid. Germany with this very significant reversal of long-standing German foreign policy to send weapons into a conflict zone. So the NATO members have responded in a very significant way, not just in military terms, but certainly in humanitarian aid, economic aid, and others. So I think the alliance is really what I see is them getting right up to the line of trying to enhance Ukrainian capabilities and its ability to defend itself without triggering an expansion of the conflict. And that's the kind of careful calculus that I think the allies are making. We don't want to give up Ukraine. And so we're doing everything possible short of risking a direct military confrontation with Russia.
And do you think, Michael Kimmich, that if Ukraine is given the necessary or almost the necessary military supports that it wants, that it can either defend itself or drive Russia from its borders?
I believe that Ukraine can defend itself. I wouldn't take it as an absolute given in the situation, we're at the beginning of a what looks to me like a long war, and Russia does have still escalatory possibilities that it could use. So it's not a done deal, but Ukraine has already showed in the last month that it's got the political will, the military intelligence, and it has a lot of powerful friends and allies, as Andrea was just describing a moment ago. So it should have great self-confidence that in the project of its own self-defense, it will do very, very well and may even in that project prevail. Now, driving Russian soldiers from Ukrainian territory is another story. I think that may happen in some places, perhaps around Kiev, perhaps in some places in the east. I think in the south, it's not looking quite as good for Ukraine, and I would be very hard-pressed to imagine a scenario in which Ukraine could push Russian soldiers from Crimea, which is, of course, Ukrainian territory. So on that front, I think there are maybe more uncertainties.
Well, and we've heard this phrase, Michael, to, escalate to de-escalate, and the thought that Russia might use chemical, biological, or some kind of nuclear tactical weapon. Does that change the calculation?
It does. I mean, of course, it changes the whole atmosphere and the optics of this war. It would sound alarm bells throughout the United States and in Europe, really throughout the world, and so it would obligate the Biden administration and its partners and allies to do something. What that something is, I don't quite know. And my advice to them would be to be not so specific about that in the immediate term. But I almost, it's not that this conversation is a distraction about chemical and biological weapons. It's important. But the real escalatory possibilities for Russia reside, I think, in air power, missile strikes, just the continued degradation of the infrastructure, the military infrastructure of Ukraine, the economic infrastructure, et cetera. That's, I think, where it's maybe more plausible that Russia will escalate. But they could, of course. I mean, Putin has shown himself to be very rash in the last couple of weeks. He could, of course, go down that road, and that would make this conflict a new one, sort of a one-of-a-kind war, I'm afraid.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Michael Kimmage, and he's currently a professor of history at Catholic University. A couple of years ago, from 2014 to 2016, he worked for the State Department, where he held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. Andrea Kendall-Taylor, senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program that's at the Center for a New American Security, and she was deputy intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia from 2015 to 2018 at the National Intelligence Council. And we are talking about Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, NATO, and of course, Russia. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me ask, and I'll ask you, Andrea, we meaning the West, NATO, the United States, other countries as well, imposing really strict sanctions on Russia. Yesterday, President Biden said they're not to deter Russia, but really to punish Russia. Has there ever been an instance where sanctions have led to the overthrow of an authoritarian government?
So I think the sanctions are to punish Russia, but I think they're to do even more than what President Biden suggested, which is to constrict and constrain President Putin's ability to continue the aggression that he has kind of systematically imposed over the years. And you can see that with the sanctions going after Russia's central bank, going after key sectors of the economy, and really critically, even over the longer term, we have implemented these export controls that will limit the flow of certain technologies that are important to Russia's ability to innovate, which drives its economy, but also very important for its military industrial complex. So in my view, the sanctions aren't just punishment, but really a way to limit Russia's capacity for destruction. The question about, how effective might the sanctions be is a much more difficult one. Mm-hmm. I think the academic literature on the efficacy of sanctions is a bit divided, but there is some evidence to suggest that sanctions against the particular type of regime that Putin rules over, which is this highly personalized political system where power really is concentrated in the hands of Putin and a very small group around him. Those regimes are extremely dependent on corruption and on patronage. That's the grease of the system. And so if the sanctions can disrupt those patronage flows, I do think it has the ability to undermine that Putin regime over time. Of course, President Putin has a lot of tools at his disposal to be able to weather this increasingly difficult domestic environment. But at the very least, these sanctions should significantly limit Russia's capacity for aggression in the future.
Do you agree with that, Michael Kimmage?
I do. I think that the key component of the sanctions, in addition to all that Andrea has described, is to block technology transfer to Russia. That's one of the things that Russia has really gained from since 1991. It's opening up to global markets and to Western markets, and it's modernized its military in part on that basis. So it's very, very important to minimize. I don't think we can eliminate technology transfer to Russia, but to minimize it. You know, I do think, just in my own view, that anything that suggests that sanctions are connected to regime change in terms of what the Biden administration is trying to accomplish is not correct. I don't think that's sort of within the capacity of sanctions. I can't think of a historical example of sanctions leading directly to regime change, and I don't think that that's the intention of the Biden administration. It doesn't really want to get too involved in domestic Russian politics. It really wants to stop the war effort or to complicate the war effort, make it more difficult. And there's a bit of lack of discipline on the messaging on that point, but I think that that's the core effort that the Biden administration is trying to make.
We're almost having a break here, but a comment from Ray. He says, please expand on NATO. What is NATO's purpose? And Michael, if I can toss that back to you, give you about 60 seconds to respond. What is NATO about?
Well, NATO was founded in 1949 as a defensive military alliance and is the most brilliantly successful example, I would say, in all of history of doing precisely that. It began in Western Europe with the Iron Curtain dividing it from a Soviet sphere of influence in Europe, and then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO expanded to include now 30 countries, and so it stretches from Estonia in the north to Turkey on the Black Sea to the countries of Western Europe to the United States and Canada. So it's an enormous alliance, and it's meant to encourage democratic values, to instill peace among its member states, and to ensure that these states are defended, and its track record in all of these departments is just superb.
And that is Michael Kimmich, who joins us along with Andrea Kendall-Taylor, and we are talking about many things, including NATO, the war in Ukraine, Russia's aggression. We've been talking earlier in the hour with Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick about the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break, including, you know, how do you end a war where no one is likely to win? We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking about what we've been talking about over the last month, the war in Ukraine. And today our guests are Andrea Kendall-Taylor, again, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Michael Kimmich is with us as well, Professor of History at Catholic University and a Fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He's got a forthcoming book titled The Decline of the West, An American Story. And both of them have worked on issues related to Ukraine and Russia. Well, I do want to talk about this particular war, and you both have written about, using your own words, your own language, that we're really witnessing a war where no one is likely to win. And I wonder, Andrea Kendall-Taylor, if I can begin with you. I'm looking at a headline, Why Putin Probably Won't Give Up Anytime Soon. We're looking at a stalemate.
Currently, I don't think we're quite at a stalemate yet. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I don't think that either side, or particularly the Russian side, is not yet genuine about its intent to negotiate. I think at this phase that both sides likely feel that they have some sort of advantage that they can push, and that leads them to continue this fight on the battlefield rather than at the negotiating table. For President Putin, I think it's very much an open question about what he understands is happening on the battlefield. Of course, we're kind of bombarded with headlines about how poor Russian forces are performing in Ukraine. But I'm not sure that that is exactly what President Putin understands. And it is plausible that he's being told by his generals that there is hope and that Russia can turn the corner and make progress in its military aims. So he certainly, I don't think, views this as a stalemate. I think Russia probably feels that there is more that they can do. And even if negotiation is in the distance, you know, in President Putin's thinking, what he is trying to do is, you know, continue to increase Russia's advantage in the negotiations. And as Michael talked about, they're indiscriminately hitting civilian targets, trying to break the will of the Ukrainian people in order to get President Zelensky to bend to Russian demands in some future negotiation.
Well, picking up on that and going to you, Michael Kimmich, and you've written several articles about this, as you describe, this kind of unwinnable war, and the choice that Zelensky could have, which is either an unjust peace or a devastating war.
Yes, that does seem to be the overall calculus for Zelensky, and it's, of course, an agonizing place to be. I think that he can count on his side some great victories already. He's certainly shown that Ukraine is a formidable, viable, and unified country. He's shown that Ukraine has some real friends around the world, probably most importantly, the United States. And so I think, you know, he can have a degree of optimism in all of that. But none of us, you know, whether it's NATO, whether it's the U.S., whether it's Ukraine, can eliminate Russia as a power in Europe. It does have the largest conventional military in Europe. And of course, it's a nuclear power. So Russia cannot be taken out of the equation. And everything Andrea said a moment ago is really of the essence. You know, Russia is failing in its political project in Ukraine. I think that that's clear. It's not going to take over the country. It probably won't even be able to partition the country. But for Putin to sort of acknowledge that, to turn around, to start withdrawing, to negotiate in good faith, that too is difficult to imagine at the moment. So Zelensky has to navigate all of that. And he has to balance the humanitarian needs of his people, which are acute, of course, with the long-term questions of Ukrainian independence and sovereignty, which are going to be difficult for him to guarantee. So he has to thread that needle.
Well, let me ask you both, but I'll start with you, Michael Kimmich. And many have said this has been a strategic blunder, a strategic error on Putin's part. Does it show that Russia is not the quote-unquote superpower that it claims to be?
I think you could say that. I mean, some of the things that give it superpower status, sort of its geography, its size, and of course the nuclear weapons, that circumstance is not altered by the war. But I suppose you could come up with a more refined definition of a superpower, which is a superpower does what it, you know, does what it wants, or is able to do what it wants. And in that sense, Russia has failed in such a visible way. It's really done the things that it was trying to prevent. It was trying to prevent a strong Western military connection to Ukraine. And in fact, its actions in Ukraine are enhancing that. It was trying to splinter Ukrainian politics and to eliminate Ukrainian statehood. And by contrast, it has strengthened those things. The devastating effect on the Russian economy may not be felt over the next couple of months, but it will certainly over the next couple of years. You have the flight of educated Russians from Russia. So how, by any measurement, is that good statecraft? I mean, it's just a series of counterproductive moves that, when Putin departs the scene, are going to leave Russia, you know, a much weakened, troubled, and of course, a country with a moral legacy of aggression in Ukraine that's going to be there for generations. So I think in every respect, it's a blunder.
I mean, do you see him leaving the scene? I realize you have no crystal ball, but do you see him leaving the scene anytime soon, or is that just, you know, a giant question mark?
I don't. I mean, I think that he'll be around for a while, and I think if I had to bet, I would say that there would be an uprising perhaps within the intelligence services, security services, or in the military that would replace him with somebody else. I have a hard time envisioning a sort of street protest or a political movement that replaces his power. So I think the structures that he commands are here to stay for quite a while, I'm afraid.
And to you, Andrea Kendall Taylor, is it possible to negotiate with Putin?
It's not possible yet. And what we see, you know, from his public rhetoric is a leader who is not interested in negotiations. And if anything, you know, he continues to kind of double down and hold firm on Russia's core demands. I also think we see Putin starting to mobilize Russia domestically in support of this war, which again doesn't suggest to me that he's in a mind frame of wanting to bring this war to an end anytime soon. That was something that Putin did not do before this war, right? So Putin believed going in that this was going to be a short and sharp war. I think he wanted to keep it out of the Russian domestic public eye. And that helps explain, I think, why we've seen so many of the blunders evident on the battlefield. But the fact, you know, we had just seen scenes with, you know, thousands of people packed into a stadium in Russia in support of the war. They're talking about now mobilizing conscripts. So again, both his public rhetoric and the actions he's taking, I think, to mobilize society around this war effort suggests that he is not in the mind frame or moving towards negotiations anytime soon.
And in terms of what he wants, we know he has said this, he doesn't want Ukraine to join NATO, and that hasn't happened yet. He sees Ukraine as part of Russia. He's there to, quote unquote, denazify Ukraine. To you, Andrew, so what does he want, bottom line? He meaning, of course, Putin.
Yeah, I think he's been pretty clear on what his demands are in Ukraine. So what you just said, first and foremost, is Ukrainian neutrality, that they will not join any military alliance. They're also talking about demilitarization, which is a very vague term and unclear exactly what that means from the Russian perspective. They're talking about, you know, forcing Ukraine to accept Russian control over Crimea, which they illegally annexed in 2014, and to recognize the independence of Luhansk and Donetsk in the Donbass region. And I think they're also, as part of their negotiations, bringing into the mix some sort of sanctions relief from the West. So I think those are kind of what he is after. But in the bigger picture, and this was something that Michael said before, I don't see how Putin can achieve any of his larger political objectives. You know, we have seen those objectives evolved. I think when they went in, there was a sense that they were going to be able to take all of Ukraine to fold it back into the Russian Empire. But the way that the Ukrainians have fought, it suggests that that is not going to be attainable. And if anything, you know, even in parts of eastern Ukraine, areas that might have been a bit more sympathetic to Russia and to Putin in the past, their views have hardened in an extremely anti-Russian direction. So, you know, there are some particular things that they might be able to negotiate, but this broader objective of bringing Ukraine back into Russia's fold, exerting Russian influence over Ukraine, there is no way that Putin will succeed in that over the long term.
Well, let me pick up on something, and Michael, I'll go back to you. And if Russia is able to annex eastern Ukraine and maybe Crimea, and as Andrea mentioned, and as we have seen, the destruction of eastern Ukraine is breathtaking. He's going to have to deal with some kind of insurgency. The people have turned, even if they were sympathetic to Russia a month ago, it's hard to imagine they are today.
Well, that's certainly correct. I mean, it's probably a question in terms of logistics of how much territory he would want to acquire. And since we're speaking about a sort of political settlement, it's also a question of what he could achieve. If he can achieve something at the negotiating table, and, you know, if Kiev is going to accept that and Moscow signs on to it, then I think the prospects of an insurgency are a bit different. If they want to just keep on going and still persist in this project of partitioning a large part of the country, they'll be faced with a devastating insurgency. But frankly, I think militarily, they're very, very far from that at the present moment. The maps that suggest Russian control over all this territory are quite misleading. It's sort of little islands of control, but the supply lines are very vulnerable, which is one reason that Russia is doing so poorly on the battlefield. So, you know, rationally speaking, I think Putin can't really get that much, and the question is whether he'd be willing to settle for that not much to end the war, or if he'll just keep the war going out of frustration.
Here's an email from Susan, and a lot of our listeners, I think, feel the way Susan does. She says, I understand the NATO bond. However, it seems to me that if I was watching my neighbor's home burning, as a good neighbor, I would try to put out the fire. It isn't an unwinnable war. We just need good neighbors. And I wonder, Andrea, can you speak to that? I guess the frustration, the anger, the sadness to watch a country get destroyed, and we get to watch it on TV.
I entirely sympathize with that note from your listener. And that is just really the painful reality of this current situation. It has created huge moral dilemmas for the United States and for NATO. But again, the challenges, you know, as I said before, I think we're left in the position of wanting to do more to help Ukraine defend itself. So that, you know, that is an understandable imperative. That's why we're hearing people call for no-fly zones or sending certain helicopters into Ukraine to help them. But there's this delicate balance, I think, where the administration, again, moved by that desire to do more to support and protect Ukrainians, they're trying to get right up to the line by flowing in weapons, different surface-to-air missiles, ammunitions. I mean, all sorts of equipment is flowing in, more military aid than we've ever sent into Ukraine in the past, in order to try to support their ability to defend themselves. But the risk is still there. I mean, this, you know, what it would be, you know, just as horrible as this war is for Ukraine, it would be even more horrible if this war expands to include a direct military conflict between NATO and Russia. That would be devastating. And so that's the very delicate balance of how do we support Ukrainians? How do we protect them? But we have to avoid sparking this direct military conflict with Russia.
And that is Andrea Kendall Taylor, who joins us along with Michael Kimmich. And we are talking about the Russian war in Ukraine, on Ukraine, certainly the suffering of the Ukrainian people, what options NATO has. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Here's a question from Tom, and I'll put this to you, Michael. He says, won't Putin simply tolerate the suffering of the people of Russia and Ukraine just like Stalin? Is that how we should think of him?
I suppose the answer would have to be yes. This is a man who is completely insulated from any kind of accountability within his own political system. There's no election or investigative journalism or, you know, outside body that could impose its will on Putin to that degree. He is impervious, and I think we have to also factor in a long track record of brutality. You have Putin coming to power around the year 2000. He prosecutes a very brutal war in Chechnya for several years, which is in some respects the template for what Russia is doing now in Ukraine. And then in 2015, partnering with Bashar al-Assad, Putin is the perpetrator of many war crimes and humanitarian atrocities in Syria. So he doesn't balk at that kind of thing, and I doubt that he has much empathy for the suffering of Russians who are going to be hit by sanctions and their secondary effects within the Russian economy and Russian society. So yes, I think these kinds of concerns, whether we describe them as empathy or a certain, you know, sort of concerns for the populations of Ukraine or Russia or elsewhere, that's not the calculus that Putin has in mind. He's thinking of himself historically as a great leader, reconstituting the Russian lands, and that's the criteria that he uses to measure his activities.
And Andrea, we're almost out of time here. How does Ukraine get rebuilt when the fighting stops?
Well, that is going to be a really critical question. I think through the course of negotiations, there will be a lot of effort to try to get Russia to pay for some of the reparations. I mean, again, this was a war of choice. It's a war of aggression. The kind of devastation in Ukraine happened just because Putin decided he wanted to initiate this war. So I believe, you know, the United States holds some leverage with sanctions and other things, that there will be significant effort to try to get Russia to repay some of that. I'm hearing discussion of some movement, you know, with all of these assets that the United States and the West are seizing from oligarchs, whether or not those funds could be redirected to help support the reconstruction of Ukraine. Mm. But ultimately, it's going to be a Western effort. And it will, I think, ultimately be up to the United States and its NATO allies to invest in Ukraine to help rebuild the cities, but also, you know, civil society and all of these things, so that Ukraine can, I mean, be able to defend itself moving forward. I mean, I fear as long as Putin is there, that even if the war stops, there will be persistent efforts to kind of continue to undermine Ukraine, whether it's through the information realm, cyber realm, all of these hybrid tactics that existed before the conflict, don't immediately stop just because, you know, if we are able to get to some sort of political settlement. So it will be very much incumbent on the West to step up. We've already seen tremendous effort to support humanitarian efforts and the economy. So right. It will be a massive effort, but one that will be really critical to build some momentum
Indeed.
Towards.
Well, we have to leave it there. Andrea Kendall Taylor, thank you for joining us on Radio Times today. And Michael Kimmage, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.